From WBEZ Chicago, I'm Greta Johnson, and this is the Nerdette Book Club. It's just like a regular book club, except sometimes the author stops by. It is the month of March, and our selection this time around is Kaveh Akbar's novel, Murder! It is about Cyrus, who is an absolute mess, but he is contending with a lot. He and his dad moved from Iran to Indiana after his mom died when he was little. Since then, his father has also died, and Cyrus is struggling with addiction. He has never slept well, and everything is deeply depressing. He's a poet, but he's not sure what that even means, and he's haunted by existential questions about what makes life worth living and whether anything is worth dying for. When he learns about an Iranian artist exploring similar questions at an exhibit in New York, he hits the road to learn as much as he can. That is all I am going to say for now, since this is a spoiler-free conversation. Kaveh, welcome to Nerdette.
Thank you so much for having me, Greta. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh my gosh, thank you. I really loved a lot of things about this book, but I think especially like the deep Midwesternness of it all was just really lovely to see.
Yeah, I love the Midwest. I've lived a lot of different places in the Midwest. I've lived in Milwaukee and Indiana. I've visited Chicago constantly throughout my life. I now live in Iowa. I was also born in Iran, and I've also lived on the coasts and in Florida, et cetera, et cetera. But the Midwest is home for me, and it's a place that I think a lot of people see as quite unliterary in certain ways. You know, you read a lot of brilliant New York novels or campus novels set in the Northeastern, you know, Ivy bedecked institutions, or like people traveling abroad, or California sort of travel novels and things like this. But I love the space of the Midwest. I love the big monolithic skies in the Midwest, and I love the general Midwestern affect too. I think it's so fascinating and plumbable, and I wanted to bring that into these characters.
It's so funny because I originally wrote that question to say that I found it really refreshing that this wasn't a Brooklyn novel. Mm-hmm. And then Anna, our producer, pointed out that like half of it does technically take place in Brooklyn. It was so funny to unpack because it was like it doesn't feel that way at all.
But when he goes to Brooklyn, it's very country mouse in the big city feeling.
That's true.
He's taken in by the skyscrapers. He says, Cyrus, the protagonist of the book, says that he knows that the native New Yorkers aren't supposed to look up. You're just supposed to look straight ahead. You can always tell that you're a tourist by looking up. But he keeps looking up because he's just so dazzled by them all. And it makes him feel good to still be permeable to wonder. But it also makes him feel a little bit like a rube.
So I want to talk more about Cyrus. As I mentioned, he is a mess. He's still somehow really endearing at the same time, though. There's a real sweetness to him, too. And I know you and he share a lot of kind of like biographical bullet points. But obviously, you diverge a lot, too. Mm-hmm. But I would love to talk about some of your similarities and differences.
Yeah, so both Cyrus and I were born in Iran and moved to America as children. Both Cyrus and I are addicts in recovery, though I'm a little bit further along in my recovery than Cyrus is. Cyrus is in relatively new recovery. I've been sober for 10 and a half years. We're both writers, though Cyrus is sort of fledgling in that regard. And, you know, I've published a few books and this and that, but... And so there are these sort of biographical symmetries, but he also feels quite distinct from me in certain ways, or he feels like a person that I have been, but maybe have tried to grow beyond in certain ways, psychospiritually. You know, he's constantly getting in his own way and saying the wrong things to the wrong people and being callous or negligent of the people who love him. And, you know, he sits across from a dying woman talking about contemplating suicide and the ethics of suicide as she's dying right in front of him. Mm. And he does all this with an absolutely chilling lack of irony. Mm. Right. He's just so obsessed with his own psychic life that it's hard for him to see very past it. Mm. And certainly that's something to which I can relate. Hmm.
He's so flawed, but I feel like you treat him so tenderly, too.
I mean, I know him, right? I was him. I'm sure I am him often. And, you know, a big part of my life still to this day is working with other people in recovery and new recovery who are very, very much still just wrapped up in their own psychic lives and unable to look past their own misery or self-pity. And I love them too. And they often speak in rhetorically unhygienic ways, and their ethical fitness is not always impeccable, you know, and I love them because I see how hard they're trying to get well.
You talked about having moved a lot. I wonder, like, what do you think of as home these days?
I mean, the sort of literary pinky in the air answer is that I think of the page as home. You know, I think that has traveled with me wherever I've gone.
That's,
I mean,
gorgeous.
I used to, you know, Farsi was my first language, Persian was my first language, English was my second, and then we prayed in Arabic. And so there was always this sort of permeability in the language. There was always this porosity, this fluidity, right? A book could either be a book or a kitab, you know, and I would just choose whichever one I felt like saying, you know. And I think that, you know, if I, the only truly honest way to answer that is to say it is the language. I mean, I live in Iowa City. That's where my spouse and my dog and my cats and my books are. But I've only lived there for a year and a half, you know. I mean, it is home in that it is where I fly back to. It is where my good pillow is. Right? you know, if I'm really, you know, if I'm at the pearly gates and I'm supposed to say, like, what feels most like home or what felt most like home in that world, it's just sitting in front of a page with a pen.
That's beautiful. So your book has a couple different elements to it. There's Cyrus and his story. There is the book that he's writing. Mm-hmm. And then there are the dreams, which are so playful and absurd and strange. And it's kind of hard to even describe them. But I mean, you've got one between Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Cyrus's younger brother named Beethoven, who doesn't actually exist, right?
The make-believe little brother named Beethoven after the titular dog in the 1992 children's movie, not after the famous composer.
So I wonder, like, as you're constructing this novel, at what point were you like, oh, dreams, for sure, dreams?
Honestly, the dreams came first,
really?
Kind of. Yeah, I mean, I wrote them as a way to get to know the characters. You know, I'm someone who just writes a ton. I write so much and I publish so little, right? relative to how much I write. And so there are all of these dreams, you know, and I write everything by hand. So, you know, there are just countless drafts of conversations, just me getting to know the characters. You know, I didn't go into this being like, I have to have a plot and here's what has to happen on page 100 and here's what has to happen on page 2. You know, I thought of characters doing things that interested me.
And I was like, how can,
And then I hung, that's a beautiful way to say it. And then I hung out with them, you know, like sticking my hands up in the sock puppets and making them talk to each other.
Yeah.
Right. The dreams were a way of learning about these characters. And then, you know, once the book began to come together, I realized that I as a person in this life take dreams very seriously. You know, the first thing I do every morning when I wake up is ask my spouse if they've dreamt, you know, because, you know, on a good day, if they remember their dream, then I get to start the day with my favorite person telling me a story, you know, which rules. It's really nice. I just like being told stories and I like my favorite person.
Yeah.
And so I knew that I wanted to try to create a text that took dreams seriously. And so, you know, I was reading pretty ravenously as I was writing this novel. And in that reading, I started to look for texts that also treated dreams with seriousness. Texts like The Quixote by Cervantes or, you know, any of Borges's fiction or even TV shows like The Sopranos, right?
Oh,
that
yeah.
take dreams very seriously. And what I found them to all have in common is that when there are dream sequences, there are slivers of narrative within the dreams, right? Which is to say they're not a pause in the narrative or they're not ancillary or parallel to the narrative, but they actually incorporate elements of the narrative and advance it, even if subtly. That was really, really fun to write.
That's really cool. I love that. Our January book club pick I mentioned to you was Jonathan Abernathy, You Are Kind, which is about a dude who's deeply in debt who is hired to edit the dreams of workers so that they work better, which is
chilling.
Yes, I had a feeling you would find that intriguing.
Well, one of the things that I love about dreams is that they're so dreams and poetry are both so just unuseful, you know, in any sort of like in any way that is legible to empire.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's no the fundamental stuff of dreams is, you know, ideas and fears and anxieties and beloveds who you miss and, you know, mysteries that you're trying to unravel about yourself or about the world around you, right? And none of this stuff is legible to Empire in any way, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why I think, I mean, not to be sort of tinfoil hatty or soapboxy or whatever, but I do think that there's a reason why culturally Americans are dissuaded from talking about their dreams. And, you know, you're sort of taught to roll your eyes when someone starts to, because it's like, if you linger there, you're not being productive, right? It is like the antithesis of productivity, right?
For sure. Yeah. In her book, they vacuum up all the disturbing stuff and then they can sell that to the highest.
Which it's is beautiful. Like, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's exactly what I'm talking about.
I had
about.
A feeling you would dig it. Yeah. So how did the title come to be? I think the exclamation point is so perfect.
Yeah, me too. I really like it. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to just be like gassing myself up like that, but I just, I feel very, very good about that decision. And it was one that, I mean, just most simply, I think had I called it Martyr without an exclamation point, it would have seemed very dour. It would have seemed very sort of self-important, self-serious.
Yeah, there's like a whimsy that you've added to the word martyr that you don't often see with the word martyr that I think does like suggest a lot about the tone of the book.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I mean, exclamation points are like rhyme. They're inherently funny, you know, just like the idea that the two perfect words for a situation happen to sound exactly like each other. Like there's something just inherently silly about an exclamation point. Mm-hmm. And I think that it vents away a lot of that, you know, you say martyr and people are like, oh, you know, like, and suddenly people think it's going to be, you know, one of those vegetable books that will be good to say that you've read, but that is like utterly joyless to slog through, you know? you know what I mean? You know exactly the kind of book I'm talking about.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like people like to brag that they've read such books, but nobody actually enjoys reading them. And that wasn't how I felt about it writing it. Again, it's not for me to say whether it is or it isn't, but I certainly had a lot of fun writing it, even though it is full of, you know, grief and ideas of martyrdom and legacy and suicidality and empire. And but it's also about Lisa Simpson and and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and the dog from Beethoven. And and so I think just sort of tonally it anticipates what's to come. And then also there's a way in which Cyrus, you know, grows over the course of the book to become obsessed with this idea of martyrdom.
Right.
And that begins to govern his mind. You know, he wants to go out, but he wants to do it in this way that will sort of retroactively give his life meaning, you know? And that feels very staccato to me in the way of an exclamation point versus the sort of rolling ellipses of like every day waking up and just trying to, you know, find meaning like, oh, he set himself on fire in front of a Bank of America, you know, like, and now his whole life is meaningful because of this final gesture. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that feels much more exclamatory.
Well, I think it's so interesting thinking about the duality that you're getting at, even with the idea of being a martyr, right? Because there's like the really scary, you know, extremist terrorist definition of martyrdom. But also on the other hand, there's something really beautiful about the idea of like having something that you care about enough to be willing to die for it, you know?
Yeah. And that's something that, I mean, Cyrus is an Iranian in America
right.
who came up through 9/11, just like I did. And there's a part of me that is very afraid to, I mean, you've seen the book cover. It is the word martyr with an exclamation point and then my very ethnic name underneath it, right? And I saw it this morning coming here in the Hudson News, you know? They sell it in airports. Like, that's nuts to me, you know? Like,
the airport of it all is,
that's
like,
what I'm saying.
That's amazing.
What I'm saying. And like, that is not inert, right? And it is not the same thing as if my name was, you know, Jeremy Thompson or whatever. I'm sorry to the Jeremy Thompson out there, but
Jeremy's okay.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like it's a different thing.
More with Kaveh in just a minute.
So speaking of historical events, there is an event that is pretty crucial to the storyline in this book that I had never heard of. It happened in 1988. So I guess in my defense, I was very young, but still it's something that we really don't talk about. This was that the US Navy had attacked an Iranian plane And everyone on board was killed.
Yeah, so July 3rd, 1988, the USS Vincennes, stationed in the Persian Gulf, shoots Iran Air Flight 655 out of the sky, killing all 290 people on board, including 66 children. They said that they mistook it for a fighter plane. I think that the fact that you've never heard of it and you're not alone. I think the vast majority of Americans have never heard of it. Or if they have, you know, like there's certain people for whom if you say the USS Vincennes incident, right, you know, they'll be like, which one was that again? You know, they'll maybe have like a vague recollection. Sure. It had to do with Iran. But the fact that we don't remember it is testament to just the ubiquity of such events, right? The fact that they are legion, that they happen constantly, that it was probably one of several such instances of our accidentally massacring innocent people who had nothing to do with anything, right? It was just like the plane that I took to get here today, just a civilian plane, right? The imprecision of American justice is taken as a given, right? You know, this idea that, oh, well, you know, that's just the unpleasant but necessary cost of being a military superpower, you know?
Yeah.
But to those 290 people, it was awfully important, you know, like
let alone their family members.
What I'm saying. Like, think about how you love your family. Like, that's how all of them love their families, you know, and this idea that they could just be like absented from the world and then just utterly forgotten. You know, I think that part of the project of the book. So Cyrus's mom was on that flight narratively in the book. And part of the project of the book is to show that this one act, this one individual act of the violence of empire that kills 290 people, one of those 290 people, their death causes everything that happens in the book. Everything that happens in the book, from Cyrus's consciousness to the poems that he writes to the lovers that he takes, you know, all of it, you know, his lovers' lives are indelibly influenced by, you know, the ripples of this event that happened 30 years before.
Yeah.
And so, again, when we see the Gazan death toll rising 30,000 one day, 30,100 the next day, again, my brain can't
really
contemplate
difficult.
Those numbers, you know, differentially. But when you see one individual narrative, right, when you see a girl talking about, you know, her parents, right, suddenly that comes into clarity and the magnitude of the whole 30,000 comes into clarity, right? I think that is one of the great ethical superpowers of art. And I'm really, really interested in sort of leveraging that however I can.
Mm-hmm. How did you first learn about it?
Ooh, I that's a great question. I think at some point, my mom was pregnant with me in Iran when it happened.
I was going to say you weren't yet born, right?
Yeah, my mom, it literally happened while I was in utero. And so there's this way in which my mom, you know, they posted all these pictures because in Iran, in America, they forget about it. In Iran, they propagandize it, right? You know, it's put on postage stamps and they show you pictures of all of the dead, right? And especially the 66 children, right? I literally have a Persian postage stamp that is still in circulation of, you know, the USS Vincennes. It's called like the America flight disaster or massacre. The word they use is massacre in Farsi. But you know, the same way that we talk about 9/11 today, right? I when I first heard about it, I don't remember. I was a kid at some point. I think maybe it was just surfing Wikipedia when that became a thing when I was in like middle school or high school or something. I would go to the public. We didn't have internet at home until after I went to college. And so I would just surf Wikipedia at the public library.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's
and I think
so
that,
nerdy.
I know. I think I was just like, I think I like Googled Iran or something and then like just to like learn about, you know, and there was like an old Newsweek cover that said Gulf tragedy in big letters, right? And there was a op-ed by Henry Kissinger about like, how should we handle Iran now, right? I'm not making this up, your listeners can Google it. What is interesting about that is that a few years prior, Russia had downed a Korean airliner in very similar circumstances. And the Newsweek cover was like, murder in the air.
Right.
It was like murder in the
disaster,
air.
Disaster, murder, massacre,
yeah,
accident.
Exactly.
Like, what other words? How can we elude?
So like when it was Russia who did it to Korea, it was murder in the air. When it was the US who did it to Iran, it was the Gulf tragedy.
Tragedy.
Yeah.
God. Ugh.
So with this book, I mean, we've already illustrated it. There are a number of really intense topics in it. It can be devastating, but there's also a lot of glee and delight and brightness and weirdness. And I wonder, like, I can't imagine that you actually had like a sad, happy tally going in your brain as you were writing it, but how intentional were you about kind of like trying to strike a balance there?
Yeah, I there was no tally. I didn't have any sort of written tally, but I am conscious of ensuring that the reader has reason to stay in the ride, you know? Mm-hmm. I think the opportunity cost of reading is massive today.
You mentioned that in another podcast. Loved it. I think it's a fascinating.
It's so true. Totally. I think about it constantly. I mean, in the acknowledgments for this book, I sort of mention it too. Like just the time is your most irreplenishable resource, right?
Yeah.
Like you can make more money, you can make more friends or whatever, you know, I mean, that's a weird example, you know, like, but like time is certainly more irreplenishable.
It's our most precious resource.
Yeah. And to give 10 hours of it to a novel, right? Like I've been a poet before this. So, you know, even if you're giving me your time, you're spending like a couple minutes with a thing, you know, and which is still a gift, right? This is several orders of magnitude greater than that. And so someone who sits down and reads my novel for 10 hours, like you could have learned, you know, enough French to order in a restaurant off Duolingo. You know what I mean? Like you could have learned how to tango well enough to do it at a wedding, you know, off YouTube, right? Like there's the opportunity cost is massive, right? And so if you are hanging out with me for 10 hours, for 12 hours, listening to the story that I want to tell you, I don't want it to be this slog where you just feel like I'm, you know, berating you or, you know, just like cudgeling you with doom and despair, right? Because A, that's not what my reality feels like. And B, that feels like a kind of fundamental violation of the contract that we have, right? Where you are giving me a measure of attention in exchange for, you know, what Horace would call delight and instruction, right? Mm-hmm. And if I'm only giving you instruction, if I'm only saying like, here is the moral, you know, and I'm not giving you any delight, then that feels like I'm sort of violating your trust in a way, right? The comedian Richard Pryor said he wanted to get you laughing so your mouth would be open when he poured the poison down, right? Which is kind of another way to say that, right? Like, it's basically paraphrasing Horace.
It's an instructive poison.
Yeah. It's like you gain purchase to a reader's interiority through a measure of delight, and then once you're in there, then you can be like, and by the way, you know, I have some thoughts about Empire. You know what I'm saying? But like, if I don't want to just be a guy with a bullhorn shouting at you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So speaking of poetry, this is a whole ass novel. How is that different for you as a writer?
Well, it's a lot longer. It's a lot more words.
Right.
I think that my poetry books were like 30,000 and 20,000 words respectively. And this is like 85. And I probably wrote like 150.
Oh my God.
And so it's just a lot longer. It all has to fit together in a way, the poetry, you know, like if you change something narratively on page 20 in a novel, then that ripples through to page 37 and to page 51 and to page 120. You know what I mean? Like it's like even these tiny changes that feel totally cosmetic end up becoming kind of tectonic, you know, and I had no, history with that. Right. My poetry books are, I mean, bunch of poets are going to come and like break my kneecaps for saying this, but you know, like it's, you know, they're not modular, but it's very like vibes based. You know what I mean? Like it's like you want to give the reader a sense of propulsivity, but it's like off vibes in my work. I don't really write particularly narrative poetry. And so that was hard. And then also like just getting people through doorways and explaining how they grabbed the check and like, you know, and like explaining how they got the money for a plane ticket. And, you know, like this sort of stuff is something I'd never done before in my life. I've been writing since I was a kid, right? I've called myself a writer since I was a kid, but
that is the opposite of vibes.
Yeah, 100%. You have
to. It's like the literal mechanics.
And you have to have that stuff because the reader, the first thing a reader wants to do is be like, well, where, how did he get on that plane if he's da-da-da-ba-da-ba-da, you know, it, like that sort of attitude, right? You know, the whole sense of like, whoa, he couldn't do, you know, like that guy at the magic show who's just shouting like, mirrors, like he did it with me.
It's in his pocket.
Yeah. That sort of attitude, right? Like you have to get out in front of that at every turn without it just feeling like exposition cudgel, you know what I'm saying? And so like you have to like you know, as your assistant is hovering, you have to like roll the hula hoop over them to show that there's no strings. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you don't really have to do that in poetry, right? Just say, I don't know, she's hovering. You know, you figure it out, right?
That's fascinating. This book has gotten like such amazing critical feedback. It's been wild to see how, I mean, yeah, I wonder from your point of view, like what it is like to put such a deeply personal and just like obviously very heartfelt novel out in the world and have people be like, fuck yeah, dude.
It's weird. It's really, really weird. To be honest, when Knopf bought it, I was like, you guys know what you're doing, but this is a weird book. Like, I don't see how it's gonna, you know, I mean, I'm an Iranian guy writing about addiction and Lisa Simpson and like this really weird niche center of a lot of different Venn diagrams.
But those are the best ones, right?
And I think that that is what everyone kept telling me, you know, like it is in its sort of specificity and weirdness that it becomes sort of interesting. You know, it's not just, you know, Jack Ryan, or I'm sorry, I don't mean to be like talking shit about other, you know, whatever, but you know, it's not just like some guy with a gun and saving
the
president
location.
From and they gotta find the Magna Carta in the ruins or whatever. It's clear I don't read a lot of like sort of pulpy thrillers.
No, that's totally a book I've read for sure.
Yeah, but you know what I mean, like it's a really weird book, and it's death haunted, and it's about martyrdom from a guy with a name that sounds like he maybe ought not to be writing about martyrdom without getting put on a lot of lists, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, it's immeasurably gratifying. And also, I don't know how to talk about this without sounding like an asshole. So, of course, I'm doing it now with a microphone
Great.
In front of my face.
We love that.
Yeah. I'm sure that Knopf will love it too. But I. But I it's almost beside the point in a way. I'm immeasurably grateful for it, to be clear. But I was so gratified to have written the thing.
Yeah, that's
you know,
beautiful.
Like I wanted to write this thing and had it sold to an indie publisher and came out in an edition of 500, I would have been able to go back to my very lovely life writing poetry and having made this thing, having spent 5 years making this artifact that I was really, really, really proud to have made.
Right.
Right.
No, that's great.
Yeah. And so there's this way in which it also all kind of feels like house money, you know, it also is just like gravy, you know, it's like I want it to be able to find the people for whom it is useful. And, you know, if it has a good life in the world, that will help it find more of those people.
Well, congratulations on this beautiful book, and thank you so much for coming on and talking with me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being so kind. Thank you for reading it so well.
Oh my God, of course.
That is the delightful Kaveh Akbar. You can read Martyr now. We would love to know your thoughts as always. Send us a voicemail. You can just record yourself on your smartphone and then email that file to nerdatpodcast@gmail.com. We also have the next 2 months of books already selected and announced, which is very exciting. In April, we are reading Marie-Helene Bertino's Beautyland. And in May, we are reading Amor Towles's A Table for Two, which comes out in early April. So now is a great time to get on the hold lists, especially for that one. Nerdette is produced by me and Anna Bauman at WBEZ in Chicago and is part of the NPR network. And Brendan Banizak is our executive producer. We will see you on Friday.